You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. A lot of us love our pets and animals in general, but how does that comport with eating beef or pork? And is there a better way to feed ourselves and, in the process, improve life on the planet? Financial Times chief features writer Henry Mance went on a personal journey to find out if eating meat and killing animals for consumption was worth the cost. His book, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, is a portrait of our constantly changing relationship with animals and how we can fairly share our planet. Mance says having a child made him want to take on those issues.
I wouldn't have come to the conclusion that I had to write a book about this were it not for my daughters coming along and bringing animals back into my life. So I think maybe I would have written a book about climate change. But then suddenly when you have kids, and a lot of people have found the same, I'm sure, you suddenly have all these images of animals around you in storybooks, as soft toys, in cartoons, and you realize that you're treating your kids to this vision of the world, which isn't quite right, that you're telling them we found a place for animals in our society, that we treat them very well, we respect them. And I, of course, knew from being an adult, reading the news, that it's not a great world for many animals. You know, factory farming is not great. Extinction is very real for many species. We're losing forests, we're losing grasslands, we're losing coral reefs. And so I felt that I wanted to pass on to my daughters a way of living well with animals. And I knew that first I had to go and find out what that good ethic was, because it's not something that I was taught, and it's not something that you can necessarily read. I think you have to go and visit the places, ask the questions, and I think it is important, because our future on this planet does really depend on how we treat other animals.
And you went to work in what I guess we would call it a slaughterhouse, but you guys call it an abattoir. Is that right?
Yeah, or slaughterhouse makes sense on this side of the pond as well.
And it really is. And I've heard similar stories, you know, because Iowa is such a place for raising pigs and cattle. I've heard so many similar tales from people who've worked at the packing plants around here. Although most of them work on the line and cut up the meat, they aren't sort of in that earlier stage of killing them. But I've heard a lot of very gruesome tales and how disturbing it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing about working in a slaughterhouse is that it's pretty easy to get a job in one, at least here. And that tells you a bit about whether people want to do the work. I mean, people don't last long in slaughterhouses, because it is, it's hot, it's hard work, it can be dangerous. And you are faced with the reality of a system in which, you know, we kill millions of animals, billions of animals really a year for food, in a way that is not strictly necessary, is more cultural. And I think you could justify this system if you felt this was the only way we could survive on this planet. But that wasn't my experience. I mean, I think I found the people, my fellow workers at the slaughterhouse, you know, friendly. I think you see animals which are sentient, who have emotions, who have desires to live in the world in a particular way, just go from, you know, living, breathing creatures just to slabs of meat in a packet quite quickly. And you say, does this really have to happen at this scale? So I sort of went and asked that question, and I decided that for me, it's not really necessary. It's a very inefficient way to feed ourselves.
And you also talk about zoos, and the zoos are so popular here, and how animals are caged up, animals that were meant to live in the wild. And that's always disturbed me, going to the zoo, especially zoos that don't even give them room to move, although those are fewer now. But still, I always feel like, and it's just me, my take, I feel like they don't look happy.
It's so interesting you say that, because I think lots of people have that realization now. And, you know, for me, part of the process was understanding that zoos were created at a moment in history where people hadn't seen these animals. They hadn't seen giraffes or elephants or rhinos, and they wanted to, and they were fascinated by it, and they didn't have TV or internet. And so by bringing these animals into the city center, it was a form of education about the world, and of also showing like human dominance of other species that was really fascinating to people in the 19th century. But we're in a different world now. And I think we've got the ability to see these animals on TV anytime we want. And we've also learned that these animals can't just be kept in very different climates, in very different spaces. And I think of an elephant in a zoo, for example. Elephants are clever animals. They have herds, which are, you know, run by the females. And, you know, they have many of the same behaviors that we would recognize. Like if there's a grandmother around, the chances of the calf or the young surviving is higher because the grandmother's effectively helped with the care. And I think just for them to be dumped with just two other elephants, three other elephants who they can't choose, who may not be related, who they may not get on with in a small space, I think is pretty sad. And I think more and more visitors notice that. So I think zoos should focus on those animals which probably can live well in captivity. So, you know, your frogs, your snakes, but not your big birds and your big mammals.
And you also address the issue of the climate emergency and these zoonotic diseases like COVID-19. And you say something which I found interesting. A quarter of mammals face extinction. An area of rainforest the size of what we would call a football field. A football field, I guess, for you guys is soccer, right? What we call soccer.
That's right.
Disappears every 6 seconds. And that is an amazing thing.
I find it heartbreaking having seen, I've been lucky enough to see a rainforest from above. You just, it's one of the most wonderful sights, the Amazon that I saw. And I think the reality only becomes more urgent. You know, we had flooding, I'm in London, we had flash flooding yesterday, which submerged parts of our underground system, our metro subway system. And I look at the world my kids have and I think, right, so they may not be able to see some of the mammals that I've been lucky enough to see, but they may also just inherit a planet that's unstable. And I think we really have to ask, like, what are we doing? It's not enough just to look at the headlines and be a bit scared. I think we have to look at the headlines and then change our behavior. And so if beef requires 20 times as much land and produces 20 times as much greenhouse gas emissions as pulses, then let's switch our diets and let's switch how we travel, let's switch how we live, because otherwise the planet is not going to be so friendly to us.
Well, and of course, in places like Iowa, where we have so many animals in these close confines and we have a lot of problems with that, you know, the waste seeping into the water and making the water undrinkable in some cases, especially well water. Yeah, that's become a huge issue too. I mean, it's very hard to keep this large number of animals together in these containments and not pollute everything too.
I think it's, I think we should really move beyond this type of farming. I mean, it's bad for the animals' welfare. You know, pigs don't want to be inside all their lives. They don't want to be in small spaces. They want to be rooting around. They want to be making decisions about who they're with, where they go. And the pollution is, as you've mentioned, huge. This is really not an efficient or an ethical way of producing food. And the risk of pandemics, you know, it may be, you know, we don't know enough about where COVID-19 came from, but we do know there is a history of pandemic diseases coming from keeping animals in confined spaces with poor welfare and keeping them in large numbers. I mean, that just increases the risk. So if we want to move away from that and we want to also protect our antibiotics, I mean, 80% of antibiotics in the US are used on livestock. It's, you know, we are risking the effectiveness of those very, very important drugs by using them on our farm animals.
You know, and on a personal level, I never really connected much with animals when I was younger because I was allergic to most dogs and all cats. But then my daughter got hamsters and then we got guinea pigs. Well, guinea pigs, because guinea pigs don't run away and die in corners and it's terrible to find them. But, you know, guinea pigs are around for a while. You get to know them and they get to know you. And they kind of sound like regular pigs when they make their squeaky noises. And it makes you think, and, you know, I don't want to eat pork anymore because all I can think of are these guinea pigs.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think the humans are very good at holding paradoxical ideas in their head. So, you know, because we eat pigs, we sometimes underestimate the fact that they do feel pain and they do have social behaviors and that they would like to live lives which weren't in metal crates, really. And it's, you know, there are so many sort of ways that you can see the reality. And I really think if there's a message from my book, is that people should just pause a little and just say, if I love this nature documentary, or if I love my dog, or if I love seeing those birds fly through the trees in the park, then what is it I can do to make this a better planet for animals? Because at the moment, we're moving in the wrong direction. And I think whether it's something as small as just cutting down meat a couple of days a week, you know, this all adds up. And I think our society is ready to change, just because our current path is so unsustainable.
Like during the pandemic, because a lot of these production lines were shut down, that was one of the saddest things to me was they just killed off a lot of animals, and they weren't even eaten, because they, you know what I mean, it was just this huge waste, and it was so cruel. But you see, when that system gets shut down because of a pandemic, those animals have nowhere to go.
Well, exactly. Those animals would get too big, really, for the machinery. They couldn't be killed in a cost-effective way. And I think it was incredibly sad, but it laid bare this industry that we, you know, in many parts of the world, just don't see. I mean, Iowa obviously has this presence of pig farms that make it very difficult to ignore. But many people around the country don't think about where their pork comes from, where their chicken comes from, where their eggs come from. And when they do stop to think, they say, hold on, but I love animals, but I'm not that kind of person. I think I'm a good person. I give to charity, etc. And so I really think that this pandemic should be a moment where we take stock and we say, look, we never want this to happen again. This was terrible. So how can we minimize the risks? How can we build in some resilience to our system? And I think, you know, factory farming should be very high up the list of things that we look to phase out.
So it looks like people are very interested in this topic.
Yeah, I really feel like a few years ago, veganism hit the mainstream. But I mean, I really think social media has revealed how much we care about animals. Before that, you know, journalists set the news, and we decided that, you know, fluffy animals, they couldn't take over the news too much, you know. But now with social media, I think people have, you know, the amount that people post about their dogs or set up accounts for their dogs on Facebook, and it's a lesson in actually our priorities are different. And indeed, there's even in the Netherlands, not so far from where I am in London, there's a political party that has seats in the parliament whose sole objective is to protect animals. And I think that really shows there is a section of people out there who will do huge amounts for animals. And so I think the discussion is beginning. And just to go back to the beginning, one of the times to make changes is when you have kids. You can teach your kids to have a different relationship to the natural world than you had.
That was Henry Mance. He's the Financial Times chief features writer and the author of the new book, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, where he looks at our constantly changing relationship with animals, and we talk about how we can share our planet more fairly. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Mary Swander has spent her life writing books, teaching students, and she's a powerful creative force in the arts. Now retired, Swander lives in Kelowna, just outside of Iowa City, in the Amish community. She moved there many years ago to deal with her ill health and free herself from the contaminants of the modern world that were making her feel sick. Today, Swander has an office in Kelowna where she works to promote sustainable farming, community conversations, and art. She has an online ag art circle. It's a Zoom meeting for artists. It was inspired by an online conference of the Practical Farmers of Iowa. Swander says it's a group of farmers, mostly who are also artists. Swander is now retired from many years of teaching at Iowa State University and other schools, but she is obviously not slowing down. I talked to Swander about her podcast and what she calls her fifth career.
But I'm having a great time with the podcast. I mean, that was sort of a child of the pandemic. I thought, what else can I do? Podcast. And I've always, always, always loved radio. I mean, that's probably my favorite medium. And when I was a little kid, we were living in Davenport then. I used to go down to my father's office, and, you know, he had one of those old dictaphone machines. And I would go down there on Saturday morning and I'd made up like all of these episodes and characters and plots, and I'd act them all out and I'd do all the voices. And I had an audience of one, and then I'd leave him for his secretary and she would listen to him. But so when podcasting came along, I was like, oh, how cool is this? And, you know, I could do this on my own. So I set up a recording studio in downtown Kelowna and found a very talented guy to do my tech work. And away we go.
Do you have tech at your home? I mean, because we think of, you know, being amongst the Amish.
Yeah, no, that's the funny part. I've got internet here, and the very first podcast I did was on being a online implement dealer, because the Amish, before the pandemic anyway, they used to come here and have me get online to look up various implements that they wanted to buy, because it's tricky for them. They can only have certain vintage, and it's pretty much antiques, you know, tractors and so forth. And so I was the dealer, and you know, and I'd scroll through tractortractor.com and you know, and you know, there'd be somebody sitting beside me and go, that's it, that's the kind I want right there. That one would be really good and the price is right too. I said, yeah, well, the initial price is right, but the shipping would be really, really steep. And he said, really, where is it? I said, Belize. Oh, okay. So I get these little notes slipped in my door. If Leslie still wants a corn picker, I'll sell him mine. And I said, well, that'll be 10% for me. And so I was, you know, brokering deals. It was really funny. It was really funny. And I was talking to a friend the other day, and she said, oh my God, Mary, so you basically lost your whole touring theater troupe during the pandemic. I said, yeah, major chunk of it. I said, but that wasn't the only business I lost. I also lost my implement dealership. They can't come to my house anymore for the, you know, for me to get online and help them find their manure spreader or whatever it might be.
I hadn't thought about that. I was wondering how the whole tech thing played out. So you do have tech at your house, even though your neighbors do not.
I've got a phone, I've got internet, I got a computer. So they find that very valuable. Oh, I also have a printer with a, you know, a copier. So all those things are very much valued, because without me, they'd have to go 4 miles to town in a buggy, which takes them at least a half an hour at least, and then home again.
You kind of had this situation with all these sensitivities to things, and one interest kind of fed the other, kind of helped heal you moving somewhere where you weren't around all these things, and you became more interested in sustainable farming. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and then I forgot about that part. I did teach at Iowa State, and while I was there, they started the Leopold Center and the Sustainable Ag graduate program. And so I had involvements with those two things, and it was really great for me, because I just, you know, they had seminars every week, and I went to those and educated, again, kept trying to educate myself in some of the techniques and theory, practicality behind the whole agricultural system.
Yeah, I know a lot of people in Northwest Iowa now are very much into sustainable methods. There's a couple of new programs at Morningside now University where young people are coming to learn about this and learn how to do it. And just there's a huge interest, especially amongst younger people, I've noticed.
It's really taken off. I wrote a book it was published in 1990. It was a collection of profiles of gardeners. And 1990, we had just like one heck of a time trying to find any young person involved in gardening. You know, you just, it seemed like I was like, this is insane. You know, it was all older people. And now, you know, really in the last like 10, 15 years, that's all flipped over. That's all really changed. So there's, that's very cool that young people are involved in sustainable agriculture now. I'm really happy to hear about that program at Morningside. I know there's one at Dort College too. I've been there as a visiting writer, and you know, they're popping up around the state.
You've done so much writing. You wrote books, you wrote poetry, you taught writing, you taught, I believe, at the nonfiction program at the University of Iowa.
Right.
How was it different for you to go from doing all of that and then writing plays or writing, you know, setting up podcasts?
I was an extremely shy kid. And like the teacher, the priest, everybody started calling my mother and saying, this kid sits in the back row and doesn't say a word ever, but knows all the answers to all the questions. And my mother was like, well, what's wrong with that? And they were like, she's not going to make it if she doesn't learn to talk. And in those days, the therapy for this, these days they drug you. They give you some kind of, you know, medicine. In those days, they sent you to the theater, which was one heck of a lot better. So I got sent off to children's theater, which it was just terrifying. I mean, it was just awful for me, you know, like I fell off the stage. I was such a bad actor. The other kids rebelled and asked for somebody else, you know, it went on and on like that. But I finally, you know, I stayed with that all the way through high school. And I finally learned how to, you know, get up and speak in front of people, if nothing else. And so that was like an old part of me. And then actually what happened was I walked into a class at Iowa State that I was teaching, and I told the students, I said, we're going to write a play together. And I was really interested in verbatim plays that are based on interviews and materials like that, newspaper clippings, so forth. And they kind of looked at me with this blank stare. And then I said, you know, we're going to do it this semester and we're going to put it on at the end of the semester. And so, but we don't have any money. So we can't, you know, go away and research anything that's not local. So we ended up doing it on the farmscape, changing farmscape. And they went off and interviewed, you know, people, everybody from like a conventional farmer to an organic farmer to a B&B owner to a Monsanto agent. And we brought it back, put it all together. I thought we were going to have one performance, and what do I know? There's a big demand. Leopold Center gave me a little grant to get it on the road, and it toured for like 5 years. And then what happened was I would just get one commission after another. You know, people would see those shows and then they'd ask me to write a play about X. And so that's how that all got going. And it's been a very rewarding part of my life. But, you know, so that podcasting, you know, is all just an outgrowth of my children's theater work.
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We're talking with Mary Swander, an award-winning author and a retired professor from ISU. She's talking about what she calls her fifth career, which involves sustainable farming and art. Having taught writing, you probably have a very good understanding about the fear people have of writing and writing something that isn't good or that other people think is stupid or foolish. And I mean, you don't, have you ever had that fear? Doesn't it feel like you've written so many things and you're so prolific? Have you ever?
Oh yeah, no, you have it every day as a writer. I mean, it's a wonderful question. I mean, I was working on a piece this morning and, you know, writing along, and I was like, this is this even any good? This sounds stupid. And, you know, so you constantly ask yourself that, which is kind of, it's a good thing. It's like you're developing your critical skills and you keep developing them all the way through your life. It's just amazing. You know, then I was like, I'm going to get out that other script where I did that same technique. Huh. And then I was like, okay, what I'm doing is just fine. It's even better than what I did in that script. And so, so you always, that's always, always part of it. You know, you're always going, you know, as you get older, you have a better sense of what's good and what's not. And you've got more skills, like you can get it down on the page most of the time with more facility than, you know, I had 40 years ago. But, you know, people, you know, you get on an airplane, people ask you what you do, you tell them you're a writer, and, you know, inevitably people say, oh, I'm going to write a book someday, you know, about blah, 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 you know, and I just kind of like roll my eyes and think, well, go right ahead, because people have no idea how hard it is actually to write. I mean, it's a very complex craft, no matter what you're writing, if you're writing journalism, if you're writing poetry, whatever it might be. I'm always just like totally, totally awestruck by, you know, journalists who are pumping it out every day. And it's like very well written, very well formed. I agonize over every word. I was like, I could never be like a newspaper journalist. Never. I have a thing that I call the Agart Circle that we started in January at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference. And it's basically a Zoom meeting once a month. And it's so much fun because it's basically a group of artists and farmers. And most of the people are artists/farmers. And they get on and talk about what they're doing and give presentations and show us their work. They sing songs. It's been always fun, very interesting. It's everything from children's book illustrators to Aronia berry farmers. And if you want to be part of it, just get on my website and shoot me an email. I'll put you on the list.
That was Mary Swander, award-winning author and a retired professor at Iowa State University. She lives in Kelowna. She has a podcast called Ag Arts from Horse and Buggy Land, and she's involved in promoting the arts and sustainable farming.